bad man how, bad man where, apart from you there's bad man.
Yes, there. So we are back. You just heard something brilliant off the Stormzy album. And talking of the Stormzy album, we have Mr. Fraser T. Smith in the house, everybody. Oh my goodness, I can't believe it, bro.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for being a part of this. Like, this is
big fan.
Do you know what, right? This is a conversation that is going to be very interesting to me, because if I'm being very honest, when I first met you, you had finished the Tinchy Strider record, and I had not known anything that you had done before that. So I just thought, when Ben was telling me about you, I just thought you was a guy who did that and then later on just become very successful. When I was going through your catalogue and I was seeing stuff from Kano, like early Kano, early Craig David, I was kind of blown away. I'm not going to lie. Your resume definitely speaks for itself.
Thank you. Appreciate
How are
that.
You?
I'm great. Great.
How's life with you? What's been going on?
Life is good. Well, we just finished Stormzy record.
Yes.
We mixed it here. So that was an amazing 10-month process of working with the Storms.
Can I just say as well, I feel like I might be talking through the mic that Adele recorded from. Am I? Is this one of the mics?
It is actually one of the mics,
yeah.
You know what? We should talk about where are we? Like the environment. You know, we're in the studio. Like, this is a special place.
London.
This is not like many studios that you find in London. You know, when you walk in here, it's almost like you've been teleported to LA or, you know, like recording capital of the world. Like, it's insane. Like, you've got an incredible amount of gear here. Like, the vibe, the environment is like, it's amazing. Like, every single time that I've been in here since you've moved to this studio, incredible. Like, about the space.
Well, we've been here about 5 years, and I'd always went to those studios in LA or, you know, the bigger studios in London. And it was always my dream to have a studio this size.
Mm.
But you know, when you go to them and you feel like they've just got the minimal gear in there because they've got to be neutral because different people come in every day. I thought if you could have that size of studio but just make it your own and make it homely and put your own stuff in so people felt at home, but also you could record whatever you want to at any time.
Yeah.
So we've got the piano out there, we've had string players in here, we've had choirs. I mean, we would often go to other studios to record like huge sections, but pretty much you can bring whatever you want here, which is amazing. Live drums. But I mean, the thing is that this main room is like, just feels like a bit of a hub of creativity. And I think when people come in, they can shut the door, no one's just dropping in. It just feels like it's a homely kind of vibe. When I first got in here, I thought, like, this is, you know, the dream come true. And I thought, this is actually bigger than any studio I could ever imagine being in. And then when we did Bad Boys in here, we had Stormzy plus 5, we had Huss plus 9.
I could imagine.
It was me.
I could imagine.
It was Manon. I mean, literally, I thought maybe I need to get a little bit of a bigger space, you know, just to like accommodate.
But is this everybody, like, you know, as a producer or as a young person starting to make music before you're really a producer? Maybe you're making beats, maybe you're playing an instrument. You know, getting to a point like where you can have a studio like this, it's got to be a bit of a dream. I mean, you know, were you a bit of a like kid in the sweet shop when you realized, you know what, I can actually, you know, I can actually create this? Or maybe when you walked in and it was done and you were like, yeah, it's been a journey and now I have this studio, because, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still that kid in the sweet shop. Every morning I come in here, I'm just blessed to have a space like this. I just look around at all the gear and all the possibilities. And It's just incredible. I'm not a gear snob. I think that you can make incredible music on your laptop. You know, I think that the portability of music now is amazing. You can collaborate with so many different people by going to other people's studios and have your own setup there. I'm a real fan of that as well. But I do think when you're embarking on a project like Made in the Manor or Gang Signs and Prayer, and you actually just want to camp somewhere for a few months, or 10 months, or in the case of Made in the Manor, you know, that was spread out over a couple of years. Where you want to come back to somewhere that you can feel at home and you can have the same mic set up and you can experiment with different preamps and then you can actually mix records. I'm really proud of the fact that we mixed Gang Signs and Prayer in here, because meant that for me, the first day I met Stormzy, he said about his life being like Gang Signs and Prayer, and we talked about it. We said, wow, we agreed that that should be the title of the record.
Yeah.
So if you think the very embryonic stage of a record like that through to literally the final mix where you're listening to that, which is where we first met, wasn't it, when we were mixing Number One?
Yeah, no doubt. Amazing. And do you know what? There's so much things I want to talk to you about. It's going to be very difficult talking to you about, you know, all of these different periods in your life. We're going to start from the beginning.
I'm quite old.
Yeah. It's all right. Like, I got it structured. It's all good.
We're filming this, by the way. Yeah, so yeah. For one, I say this for two reasons. One, you can see how insane the studio is.
Yeah, and, all the accolades.
If you're a young producer, you're just inquisitive and you want to know what a ridiculous studio looks like, check this video out. 100%. And two, you can see that Fraser's really not that old. He's really doing himself a disservice. Honestly, the man looks.
I'm 25. Like 45.
The man looks young as anything.
40-something grime producers.
If you get the Wikipedia up next to the video of Fraser right now, you'll see like he's done a hell of a lot in his years. So
Before I start at the beginning, though, I need to know this off the cuff straight away, seeing as though we are a little bit on the Stormzy album. Did you play a little bit of the chords on Blinded by Your Grace?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
One time for Fraser T. Smith. Please. On the chords.
Do you know what I tweeted today? I said, Blinded by Your
Grace,
Velvet and Bad Boys are my favourite songs at the moment. Mm. What's yours? And I was really surprised at how much people that came back with.
Blinded by Your Grace Part 2 is probably my favourite song on the album.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy how people, honestly,
I love that record. And the thing is, it's like I've heard in little bits of that record, right?
But I
hadn't heard the whole album. When we sat here last week and Fraser played through the album, and you know, I was like, yeah, that album's insane. But as soon as it came out last Friday, you know, downloaded it at 12, was this like midnight, was listening through it, and you know, listening again. I just like really been listening to it the whole weekend, and I was like, Blinded by Your Grace Part 2.
It's a huge record.
That is my shit. Like, Harlem Gospel Choir?
Yep.
Like, yep. Insane. And I remember having a conversation with you where you were flying out to New York to do that. And love it. The whole thing is amazing.
Yeah, I can't wait to
talk
about
that. Record.
We'll get to that. It's only because it's so relevant now because of everything that's going on. But so I know that you were brought up around Buckinghamshire.
Yeah.
Right? 5 years old, you picked up a guitar.
Yep.
Talk to me about, like, why was there a guitar in your house in the first place? Was your parents musicians?
My dad played the guitar. I was messing about with the guitar. There was no crazy musicians in my family.
Okay.
I think my great-grandma was able to play piano by ear and things like that, but I'm not from a, like, super musical family. There was a guitar in the house, and I remember going around to my grandma's house, nan's house, aunt's house. There was always a piano. It was kind of South London. There'd always be a piano in the house. That's where a lot of my relatives lived. And I just remember just always being, as a kid, just transfixed with just playing stuff and just messing around on the keys.
So would you say you're self-taught then when it comes to a lot of stuff?
Yeah.
So you just had like, because in a day where, you know, like now, you'd probably say, would it be easier by saying that you could go on YouTube and like learn how to, you know, play certain things now? Like, back in the day, obviously, when you was doing it, there was none of that going on. You was literally just spending hours and hours and hours doing it, right?
Yeah. I think, like, as I learned, I mean, guitar became my main instrument, so I took that up, and when I was sort of 12, 13, 14, you know, you'd literally be listening to records, listening to tapes, and I think that really develops your ear, especially when you're trying to learn, like, Jimi Hendrix songs and all these kind of things. As I was getting a little bit older, you know, you just to try and mimic those notes, it really sharpens up your ear. And then moving through to, then I became a professional musician.
Yeah.
And so doing sessions and being put on the spot and having to learn like loads of songs to go and do a set of like 40 cover songs. Mm. And so learning how other people wrote songs and just
how do you become a session artist, though? Like, a musician? Like, for somebody who is a young kid himself, herself just playing an instrument, a piano, a guitar? Like, how did they make that transition into, you know, even getting into a session?
That's
how did you do that?
Well, I guess it's different now. Now you can tweet people, you can whole social media thing. I think it's crazy for that, because you can put up videos and stuff, Instagram vids of playing and all that kind of thing. I think it's obviously a lot easier for people. Although, having said that, I think the market has shrunk for people needing session players on a regular basis. I mean, I do, but I'm not sure whether like everyone's using live musicians all the time. I studied and got very good at playing guitar, because I was just doing it all the time.
Yeah.
And then I came out, I did a 1 year college course at West London Institute. I got a scholarship to go there. Okay. And then came out of that after a year and thought, you know, like, the world's my oyster and I'm just going to smash it. And then found that probably for the next 3 years I was washing up in restaurants and pulling pints. And it was like a massive like culture shock, because I thought, I don't know, I was just going to be picked up, go to LA, join a band or whatever. But that was like a harsh learning curve. And then ended up doing gigs in pubs and like, you know, those really tough,
that really tough
working men's clubs and all those kind of things where you've, you know, people are pretty brutal with
their they just come in there for
response,
a drink.
That kind of thing. But that's good.
Just to go back to the education part of phrase, right, you know, because I was going to actually ask you what qualifies you to become a professional musician, but I guess you kind of answered that in terms of like the vocational side of what it was that you did. But, you know, studying at the West London Institute of Music, was that a sort of like, was that a heralded place to go?
No, not at all.
And like, what exactly were you, what were you studying? What was the day-to-day of that looking like?
That was more like an A-level in music. And it wasn't, for me, it wasn't so much about learning the notes, because I don't know, I still can't really read music. But to me, it was more about just buying myself a little bit of time while I improved. So I just got in there and just practiced like a nutter for like 9-10 hours a day. But the other thing was just integrating myself into like a musical environment, you know, a bit like the Brit School, you know, I think is amazing, where you can just breathe it and you can record with other musicians and work with singers and brass players and flautists and string players.
You said an interesting thing, you know, that you came out of that and you thought, you're going to get picked up, you're going to be in a band, you're going to be playing, but you were just washing up for 3 years. And, you know, that's quite, I think it's important, because I speak to young people that might say, I want to go and study X, Y, Z in music. And should I go and study here or should I go and study there? And not to kill any of these places, but a lot of them market themselves on like, if you want to learn to be a producer, if you want to learn to be this or that or whatever it might be. And, you know, I also studied at a music college or whatever, and I learned pretty quickly that they can teach you, you know, they can teach you the practicality of like using a software, or, you know, what it takes to, I don't know, even on a presenting a radio show. You can study so many sides of it, but getting out in the world and doing it, you know, is a different thing. And I think it's always important to make people understand that, you know, going and paying money for a course or getting blessed with a scholarship doesn't always guarantee you, you know, that you're going to walk out and you're just going to get a job, even if you have a qualification that you know, determines you're a professional, you know. And I think it's like, it's important for any young people listening to this to like understand that part of your journey, you know, because there's still a bit of a battlefield to go through even after, you know, doing what you might think are the right steps to
massively. And then you've also got to get as much experience as you can whilst not earning any money.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was the biggest thing for me, because I was like, well, how am I gonna keep practicing guitar if I'm doing like double shift washing up, or you know, that becomes really hard. But I think at that point that toughens you up, which I think is a real massive attribute to have, because I think that as you go through any business, but I mean, I think like the creative industries are really the most brutal in terms of rejection, you know. You have to so if you have to get up at 5 a.m. to practice because you need to be at work by 9, then you just got to do it, or else there isn't going to be any time, and then you're not going to get to do what you want to do. So
100%. So you obviously was going through that period of doing the bars and stuff like that. I know that you started touring as a live musician as well.
Yeah, that's when things started picking up.
Who was you touring with and what was going on around that time?
I mean, this is how random it was. I think my mum, out of desperation, because she knew like I wanted to be a musician, and after a while I was like, well, what can I do? So she gave out, I had like a demo tape, like a cassette, and she would give them out to all her friends, and it got to one lady whose son-in-law was a drummer for Rick Wakeman, who's like amazing keyboard player that played on all the David Bowie stuff and T-Rex, but then went on to do his own. He was in a band called Yes, and then went on to do his own thing. He had like loads of number ones, like progressive rock music. Mm-hmm. And his son Adam is a really close friend of mine, and so we struck up a really close friendship soon on. He needed a guitar player in his band, so this was a random thread, but my mum gave the tape to her friend whose son-in-law was a drummer for Rick Wakeman. So eventually it filtered through to Rick Wakeman, who also needed a guitar player, so I started playing guitar with him. And his music is so complex, like it's sort of 20-minute songs. It's a bit, it's a real like massive learning curve. So when you have to learn that kind of heavy musicality, I think the good thing was that when you go into other styles of music, you can kind of understand it, because that was such a massive learning curve.
How long was a concert? 20-minute songs?
Yeah, isn't it?
Jesus.
2.5 hours.
Playing three songs and he's out.
Yeah. And those songs never repeat. You're never having like verse, chorus. So just as you think you've learned one bit, you're just at the beginning of your learning. So
have you always been... Because this is one thing I feel like we definitely have in common. Even though I might be associated for DJing and playing a certain style of music, I'm very... Whatever's good to me is good to me. Mm. Like, I'm not tied down to one particular sound. Have you always, musically, with the stuff that you've just been listening to personally, have you always been very, like, very open-minded with the music that you listen to?
Yeah, massively. I think that... I don't know if it's a combination of what you listen to when you grow up, what's in the house, but, I mean, it was... To me, it was everything from Carole King to like Philly soul to the Supremes, Motown, to like some classical, Miles Davis, like very, very broad. That was just what my parents were listening to. But then obviously I was influenced growing up. I used to go to school with Tom Rowlands from Chemical Brothers. Mm-hmm. So we'd exchange things. He gave me my first Jimi Hendrix record, so I was into that, but also like New Order, electronic music, Run DMC, Public Enemy, NWA. So that just this huge melting pot. I think if you're anyone that is in music, you're gonna love everything, really, aren't you? Because there's so much good stuff.
It's 100%. I could never. That's the same thing. That's what I was saying before. It's like, I've never been a person who's just been tied down to what anything that just moves me. Mm. It could be anything. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes it just it completely just depends on the mood that I'm in. So you were touring, traveling around as a live musician.
Amazing times.
Having some good times.
Good times.
You was around working with Craig David as well. You was his guitarist. How did you meet him? How did all of that come about?
I had a studio in Maidenhead, which was in the back of a print works, which was actually adjoining a rehearsal room.
Okay.
So, but I didn't have anything to do with the rehearsal room per se. So I had this like office that I'm just funny looking around now, because like if you take it back to that first studio, it's literally like iron bars on the windows. The desk was literally a door upturned, and I just put like a sheet over the top. I mean, very, very, very basic. And I was producing there, but I was also giving guitar lessons.
Okay.
And Craig's first manager, a guy called Paul Widger, was going through to the rehearsal place, but I would like hang out at the rehearsal room sometimes, and he knew that I was a guitar player, and literally just came in one day and said, look, you know, you've got to meet this kid. And I said, well, that's because he needs a guitar player. I said, well, that's cool, but I'm getting into my production, I'm really enjoying that, I'm not sure whether like the touring thing is for me anymore. I'd done quite a lot of that. I'd feel like I'm learning more about recording, and that's the thing. He said, well, look, just meet him, I'm going to give you a like his demo, and you can check it out. And I met Craig and immediately hit it off. I think Craig was 17 at the time.
Okay.
What year was this?
Well,
this must have been
obviously 2000.
Yeah. So I'm saying that this is around the time he had a song called What You Gonna Do, which was a garage song. Mm. So it was probably around that
just
time.
At that time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just at that time. That he gave me the demo, and I don't think I've ever been as blown away, even up to this point, with someone's. I think he'd just signed, but it was on the verge of like him signing. They had Rewind, Fill Me In, Walking Away, and Rendezvous.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
And 7 days, to like top it a bit. I mean, literally was.
It's insane.
Were those songs, and there was another song called Human. He'd covered the old song.
So you know, as you heard this demo, and yeah, you were blown away by it. I mean that was an insane time, surely. Anyway, just
amazing
to even
time.
Witness and be around it. But yeah, like from your perspective, like what was happening around that time? I mean, like I've read the stories, and you know we all know what went on to happen with Craig. But yeah, I mean just. Describe that time. How was that for you? And how did you slot in first meeting Craig? You know, how was that?
Well, I guess I was aware of Garage and had been a big fan of like MJ Cole and Sonship and Kerry Evans and the Alpha Dodger, and so I knew what was bubbling. And it's interesting when you fast forward to now how grime is, you know, and it just like this resurgence of grime and how that just feels like it's now on that verge, you know. It's super exciting, it's still raw, but it's coming through in a major way, and it just felt like at the time someone had to come and break the doors down of that genre and just push it through. And when I heard this music and the way that Craig and Mark Hill from the Artful Dodger had crafted these songs, just blew me away. And I kind of got it immediately. It had the guitar in, so it like appealed to my musicality, I guess. But still, I'd always been into drums and programming drums. So just the nature of Garage and what Mark had done in terms of speeding up, like essentially halftime R&B. Tracks, you know, like Donnell Jones tracks, but giving them that energy and that UK bass sound just blew my mind. So I just thought, I mean, I had immediately got on well with Craig, and we did the first ever performance we did was TFI Friday, which was always something that was like a seminal show to do, and we got on really well, and people seemed to really like it. And then we went on and did Jules Holland, and from then on it just was like a 3-year roller coaster of gigs and shows. And obviously he did a lot in America, but throughout that we were always working together. We had like me and Craig had a remix duo called Treat, so we were actually remixing his own songs and sometimes other people's songs.
So he was getting into the production as well with you on that front.
Yeah. So he had the same kind of energy then as he's got now, you know. He's just million miles an hour. I've got so much energy and passion for music.
You told a funny story I saw about being on tour with him and deciding one day, you know what, you wanted to smash your guitar on stage, and he just was completely baffled.
Yeah, I'll show you the video.
Tell me a little bit about that.
It was, I thought I'd got to the end of a world tour with Craig, and to be honest I'd struggled a little bit on it because it was amazing. We were doing it with the whole band, so we had the like camaraderie of all the guys in the band, which was amazing. Made some great friendships on that. But I found that personally going out and playing the same music every night that was very, very strict, I found that killed me a little bit in terms of my creativity. Bearing in mind that at that point, you know, I was really doing quite a lot of production in terms of going back and doing remixes whenever I wasn't on tour. I'd just be smashing out remixes for like Dry as a Bone and lots of different artists. So then I went on tour, and it was it was cool, but because I'd done the acoustic thing with Craig, it was so, what we'd had was so loose, and he'd literally go like, let's put a 112 beat into like this acoustic section of 7 days, or let's go into like in the club 50 Cent in the middle of Fill Me In, or it was so exciting. But he'd be saying that like 20 minutes before going on stage in front of like 10,000 people, so we had that immediate thing, a little bit like his TS5 thing is now. I mean, that's basically the DJ equivalent of what we were doing acoustic. And so I don't know, it got to the point where I knew that at some point I had to leave that comfortable environment of Craig. Bear in mind, you know, his best man at my wedding. So we were and are super, super tight. So it was a very hard decision for me to make. But I'd also met my wife, who is now my manager, Sarah, and my daughter, Amber. So it was a real difficult thing for me of to course. Be on tour as well. So I thought, look, to mark the end of my period playing guitar with Craig, I'm going to go out to a shop in Sweden, I think it was, which was the last show, and I'm going to buy this old guitar which you could plug in, and at the end of Fill Me In, I'm going to rip the jack plug out and literally smash my guitar. And I thought it would be kind of funny in an ironic way, because Jimi Hendrix would set fire to it, it'd be electric guitar. You know, Kurt Cobain doing his thing with grunge, you know, as I thought, like on an acoustic guitar playing a session R&B tune, it would be kind of ironic because it wouldn't be the right thing to do. So I found it quite funny because I just literally smashed it and went into like
give a little bit
pieces.
Of edge to the show.
Yeah, but I think Craig, we never really talked about it, and I could tell he just jumped back. Like, I think this guy's
the
just
fact
lost
that he
his
never
mind.
The fact that you never spoke about it afterwards shows to me that he must have thought, this guy's an absolute lunatic. He must have just thought that in his head, what is going on? This guy is an absolute lunatic.
Did the execution go well?
Yeah.
In terms of like smashing that guitar? Because you know, like, you could have the idea so to wrong. Do something like that, and then you got to have a second run up at it because you just didn't get
no,
it right.
I was, you know what? I was very nervous about that. Because I thought, look, again, we've, you know, if you look back at those great moments where you see those sort of rock and roll icons smash a guitar, it seems to go so well.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, look, this is an acoustic guitar. If this could like bounce back and some kind of splinter go in my eye, it'd just be the wrong thing.
See, that's the type of thing that would happen to me 100%. If anything would happen, if anything would go wrong, it would be me. I'd smash the guitar and it would smash back in my face. Something like that would happen.
It's kind of like crowd surfing. Like, I've seen a few artists before, like, think it's a good idea to do this crowd surf, and they just either end up really hurting somebody or really hurting themselves, or like everyone just looks at them like, yeah, look, you're a bit too big, like, if you jump down there, we're just gonna have to let you go, you know, like. So I've got that image in my head of that
no guitar. But you know what, I've got it on an MPEG that I'll send you.
Yeah,
maybe
we'll
put it on
that.
The show. I feel like we're talking about it. We need to see that.
And talking of that, Lethal B actually did a crowd surf one time and broke his rib.
Nah, he's a man that I wouldn't want to catch.
Yeah,
I'd be stepping away.
Yeah, yes. That's a big guy. I mean, I bought a ticket for the show. I'm committed, but you know,
are you holding him up?
I don't know if I'm cut out. I don't know if I'm cut out for all of that.
So. Obviously, you're spending some. You've finished traveling the world with Craig David.
Yeah.
You're spending a lot more time in the studio now. I take it, right?
All the time.
What are you doing? Are you trying to find new acts to work with? I know you said you was doing remixes and stuff, but were you trying to find new acts to work with, or were acts coming to you off the strength of you being on tour with Craig David?
Yeah, there was a bit of that, and I think because I'd produce Can't Be Messing Around with Craig for the Born to Do It album, and then we did a track called World Full with Love, and on the second album, and we'd done some remixes. So I'd built up a bit of a thing.
And then Young G Kano, comes about. How did your worlds come together? You know, Kano, for me, when I was obviously a lot younger, he was one of the most talented MCs around that time. You know what I mean? Even today, you know, is what somebody who you know, we look at as a absolute legend. His style was very different. He was very good at telling stories. He had that from a very young age. How did the worlds come together?
I knew, and at the time, and still a great friend of mine, knew Richard Thomas, his manager.
Yeah.
And literally, Kane had worked with quite a few people, and he said to Richard that I need some guitar on a track. You know, I'm looking to do a guitar track. So Richard said, oh, I know this guy that plays guitar, Frazee, you should go and see him. I had a studio in Acton at the time, in my, like, a flat that was, like, open plan kind of flat, one end where you live and the other end, the studio. And Kane came in and was kind of shy.
Mm-hmm.
He said, look, I want to do this guitar track. I was like, cool. So I had my guitars set up, but obviously that's like, say you want to do a guitar track, it's quite an open-ended thing. I mean, was it R&B? Was it acoustic thing? Is it a rock thing? So I went through, I said, look, I'll go through some of the different types of styles that you can get, and you just tell me what you're feeling. So I went round.
Was that because he didn't really know how to describe it? Or?
Yeah, he said, well, yeah. I'm not too sure what the vibe
he'd
is.
Know what he want when he yeah. when he yeah. heard it. Okay.
So I did some acoustic stuff, a bit of like classical stuff, some like funk, and then I started playing some chuggy kind of riffs, like chunky rock
kind of
things. He said, that's what I want to do. I said, okay, cool. So that was that. I said, so what kind of music do you do? Because I hadn't heard anything that he'd done. I just knew he was a MC. He said, well, it's grime. I said, and bear in mind, it was kind of early at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Was you familiar with grime at that time? I think, obviously, Dizzy's album was already out, right? Boy in the Corner was out before
2003.
That. It was, yeah, yeah.
2003.
So, yeah, was you privy to some of that?
No, not at all.
So when he said grime, what did that mean to you?
Nothing. Yeah. So I was the guy with the guitar at this point going, okay, so a little bit of a stalemate in terms of where we're going. So I had the drum machine down there, the MPC drum machine with all the load of sounds on the pads. So I said, well, why don't you just tap out a grime beat and we'll just jam.
Yeah.
So I can tell, like, looking back at it, that was quite a big thing because it wasn't a producer, but he obviously knew what he wanted. So he started tapping, he went. Yeah. So I picked up on it and I went. And I mean, Kane, we're very, very close friends now, so I can read him and he's, you know, he's had so much success and he's a lot more open. But to put yourself back into 2002, 2003, you know, he was very young and very shy and not vocal about any of his ideas.
Mm.
So he was tapping out this beat for what must have been an hour and a half.
Oh, really?
And I remember playing this riff and Sarah, my wife, was like down the corridor and she was just looking at me and I was looking at her like, I don't really know like where this is going or whether he's into this or not. He was just sort of had his hood up and he was just tapping out this beat. So then finally he turned around and said, yeah, I think, like, this is it. I said, well, cool, let's record what you've done and I'll record what I've done. And then we put that literally on loop for another hour and a half. And I was like, shit, he's not saying anything. He's not writing anything down. It's like, is this session a waste of time? Is he uncomfortable? And then he, out of the blue, just went, which is the only thing that he said in an hour and a half. He said, cool, I'm ready. I said, ready to record? He went, yeah. And he literally
just went in,
put the whole thing down.
And belted out Typical Me.
Belted out Typical Me.
It's just one of those days. It's one of those days.
And that's one of my favourite songs of that album as well. But yeah, Kano, you telling me that as well is not a surprise to me. Because, you know, at that time, him being young and being in the environment that he's in, you know, you get a lot of young people that are just, they're not very good at having conversations with people that are outside of their circle.
Very true.
And that's why I always found it very intriguing on how a session with you two would have went with somebody who doesn't speak, is not speaking that much, with you being the guitarist, how it actually works. And I'm sure that now, as time goes on, as time had gone on, which we will talk about a little bit later, but sessions like that, probably you just get used to them after a while, don't you? Because I mean, you must get some young people that you come that come to you, maybe not know 100% of what they want and may not be so free speaking, but with the little stuff that they give you, you then have to create something out of it.
Yeah, and I think that in that environment, I didn't know of anything. I think we didn't have internet in the house at the time. It wasn't as oh, let me just play you a beat here.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So literally, we were forced to create together in a way that was really unusual for him.
Yeah,
well, there would have been no YouTube. Where were you going to go and reference a song?
No, that's like, what I mean. Only way we could do it was literally, I mean, if you think back to it, that's a tribal way of working.
Yeah.
It's like you bang 100%.
Out
your rhythm
and
I'll play something and then we'll create, literally
100%.
Tapping out that.
Because even from when I said to you before, you know, when he told you about Grime, it's not like he can say, oh, here's my phone, let me just play you a record, or like, let me just show you something on YouTube.
No.
It's just like, oh, right.
No.
Did, so, and then after that, literally, you went on to produce or co-produce a few more songs.
You know what?
Right?
Sorry, just before we move on, like, I think you just touched on a point that I thought was really interesting about, you know, going on to do other sessions with people like that who might not know exactly what they want, or making them feel comfortable and coming out of their show. And I thought, like, you know, it's probably, I'd just like to know what you think to this, but it's like, being a producer, a lot of people say, I'm a producer, and a lot of young people will say, I'm a producer, but, you know, it's not just about making music, it is almost being, like, setting the environment, almost being a therapist to a person, and creating that environment which is going to creatively and musically get the best out of them. I mean, that's how I look at it. That's how I've come to understand it over the years, because definitely when I was 15, I thought, if you make a beat, you're a producer. Like, but actually, like, you know, there's a lot of people that are amazing producers who actually may not be that musical, but they know what they know, who they need to put in the room, and they know what they need to do and the conversations that they need to have to get the record out. And I mean, I just thought it would be interesting to hear from your perspective, like, what you make of that, and what you think the difference between, like, I guess, a beat maker and a producer is.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Benny.
Mm.
That's whatever you have to do to make the artist feel at home. And yeah, the beat side of it, the music side, I think is very important. But it's important because you're painting a picture at the end of the day. So you've got to, I think, have the skills to be able to be aggressive with the music, or touching, or tender, or a combination of the two.
Mm.
So I think you have to be able to paint those colours, but there's always other people that can do that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you can work with gifted musicians, or you can work with people that make killer beats. And that's not to put down that side of it, but I do think that somewhere along the line, the beats have become so important that the other side doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that definitely the interaction between people is the most important thing, because you're dealing with
huge
emotion.
It's
and I think
huge.
That if you don't have that connection with an artist, if an artist doesn't trust you, and if an artist doesn't feel that they can be vulnerable, then you're never going to... You're never gonna reach the depths of music that are gonna truly move people.
Yeah.
And that sounds a bit lofty in terms of what I'm saying, but I think that, and don't get me wrong, I love making a beat as much as the next person, and it's massively gratifying, and I'm turned on by all the latest beat makers because I love that, but it can't start and end there.
So I guess, you know, for any young people that are listening and, you know, are aspiring producers, I guess, you know, there's no one set thing that qualifies you. You know, we spoke for a long time about the technical aspect and the musical aspect, but there's the human aspect and the human element too. So, you know, there's it's a sort of a it's a broad skill set that
it's determines. It's, you I think it's in, never ending. Yeah. That's the thing that keeps me going. I've made a lot of diverse records, but I feel that it's because it's just such a never-ending thing. I mean, I've done in the past 4 years, I think I've done 15 Berklee courses now on
Berklee Online.
For anyone who doesn't know about Berklee,
talk about that.
What we're going to get into Berklee.
We're definitely going to get into that. Just on the Kano thing, quickly. I know you went on to do a few more stuff with him as well.
Yeah.
Did you have the foresight to understand like what the album was going to do for him when you listened to it all back?
I thought,
did you realize that it actually could be something special for him in his career?
I really did because I think that the diversity on that record, the fact that he coming from his scene was even thinking about doing a guitar track, to me was crazy. And the fact that we put live drums on it, live bass, yet it was still a grime track. I thought for someone that is this young, that is thinking in these terms, is...
And understand that was a daring thing for him to do at that time as well. Because, you know, there's like the stuff that was being made in grime at that time was very, very different.
And it was a very purist,
early
genre, you know.
Yeah.
Where people were very quick to tell you,
That's not grime,
you know.
Yeah.
I always hear, that's not grime, that can't be grime because of this, and that can't be grime because of that. So,
but it's moments like this when I listen to Typical Me, it's moments like that where today I feel like you are somebody, without maybe people thinking about it, but you are somebody that people come to for growth in their sound. Do you know what I mean? Because you've been able to bring out a certain side of an artist, whether it's been them coming to you and saying to you, I need this or whatever, or whether you just having your own input and saying, I think this is for you. I think like when I listen back to the projects, each time that somebody has come to work with you, there's been a level of growth within their musical journey, you know.
I never really thought about that, but
yeah, man.
But it's interesting actually. One thing I'll say is crazy if I look back, because obviously Kano and I have worked on pretty much, I think, 140 Grime.
Yeah, 140 Grime Street, yeah.
It was the only record that we haven't worked on together.
Okay.
I think at that point, Kano wanted to go like full.
Yeah, he did London Town, and then obviously Made in a Manor as well, with most recently with Kano.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I talk, because I like doing this bit as well. Your relationship with Ben's relationship with you.
Very deep.
I know that you worked with Tinchy very early on, doing Strider Man. Ben, he wasn't.
This links in perfectly because of the Kano connection in that record, which you know what, a lot of people might not have known, but and this is pre anything to do with me, but you know, Fraser, you can say how that relationship came around, but if you listen to the hook on Strider Man, Kano actually wrote that hook.
Yes.
And you can hear it. Like when you know it and you listen to it, you can hear it. Like, okay, that makes sense. So, a great segue into this story. But Fraser, you can take it from the start, because I don't even know how that whole relationship started. But you can tell everybody.
The relationship started when I think Kane and I had finished London Town. We'd finished working on that record. And I had helped bring together. So at that time, working with Kane a lot, and I was also working with Craig David on his Trust Me album.
Okay.
So we'd done like Six of One Thing together and a few songs on that record. So I thought it would be like two of my favourite people in the world and artists. Kane and Craig would be amazing, both fans of each other. We could do a song. So we did a song called This Is The Girl, and then we did a song called Bad Boys, I think, weirdly. now I think about it. I hadn't even made that connection, but so that was Kane
little,
and Craig.
Little publishing claim there.
Yeah.
Sorry, Storms.
So Kane was doing a show, and after the show, I met Tinchy. Tinchy said, oh, I'd love to do some works. So I think Tinchy was supporting Kane on that tour.
Yeah, that's right.
So I said, cool, let's do a session. And what was very interesting is that we hit it off when we made Strider Man, and Strider Man did good things. Mm-hmm. Went to like 18 in the charts, which I think was the same position as This Is The Girl. Mm-hmm. Which was weird, because I think This Is The Girl is outwardly a bit more of a like commercial track. What was interesting then was then working with Tinchy as things moved forward. I remember being very, very set on getting him radio play, because I thought after This Is The Girl basically wasn't played on Capital, it got some Radio 1 play. Everyone at that point, all the DJs were playing like American hip hop. And I remember after This Is The Girl just thinking, I'm really upset by this, because this needs to not be this way, you know, like UK talent needs to be heard, and I'm fed up of hearing all the American stuff without any disrespect to how good it was and still is, you know. I just thought, this is, I don't know what we have to do to get radio play. So Tinchy and I started working a little bit more together, because Kane's record was out, and the next song, this is where we met, the next song that we did was Take Me Back, and we got a hook on it, which Darkus, I think, suggested that we get Tyler Cruz on the hook. And I think at that point, there was this little catalyst of Tinchy doing his thing, but a very commercial hook over a slower 4-to-the-floor beat. And I think that when we mixed it, we thought, this feels like it could do something. And that went to, I think, number three in the charts.
So you, Ben, you actually came into a working relationship with...
So the Strider Man record, I came in when the Strider Man record had been made. It was on radio already. And we had met Archie, Jack and Tinchy like a while before, but it was like this
Archie
long,
and Jack were managing Tinchy, yeah, at the time.
And you know, it was this long kind of process of just them getting a record that was, I guess, had that mass appeal or was something that felt like it could work on a major label. And yeah, me basically, you know, as per the last interview, begging Darkus to let me sign something. So we signed Tinchy, I think, the week the record went on Radio 1.
Strider Man,
yeah. And that was like maybe July 2008. And then, yeah, the record went to wherever it went to. And then, yeah, we thought we better get back in with Fraser. And you guys were already working on, I think, Take Me Back record, which had a different name. It was called something else because it had Bluey on the hook before. It was called, I've got it somewhere, but I can't remember what the original was called. Maybe we'll try and draw the demo out for the show somehow. But yeah, that was when we first met. Yeah. So it was like around probably August 2008.
Okay, and it seemed like a really good time for both, because as I said before, I remember coming to the studio around the time where you finished doing the number one record. And it felt like, at that moment, that was going to be a big moment for everybody. You know, did you get that? Did you get that sense of?
Yeah, I mean, I think without, you don't want to sound like big head. I mean, hopefully,
no, it's fine, not man. Big headed, but it's not. Stunt on them.
It's there, but you. I think when you, people always, there's some people that say they don't know what a hit sounds like, but I think with number one. I mean, bearing in mind like the momentum of what had come before it and where things were. I mean, I think you can
feel
you can hear a hit song, but I think if you put the hit in context with where the artist is at that time, I thought Well, I was really praying, like, if you have a title like number one,
I know,
if it goes
five.
In at four, you know.
Yeah. But the funny thing was, that conversation kind of happened, like, after the event. I kind of thought, yeah, that would have been mad if it didn't go
did
to
you
number
know what?
One.
Did neither, none of you thought about
maybe,
it at the time?
Maybe,
I did
maybe.
I did in my head, but I thought, I just didn't want to jinx it.
Maybe Fraser might have thought about it. But
I think you were thinking at the time about Dappy's chorus had a thing in it, didn't it?
What did it have in it? I'm trying to remember.
Something derogatory.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You remember it, but no, we'll remember
yeah,
it.
Well,
but
yeah,
it was just
okay.
There was definitely a thing that he wasn't going to change, and it was pretty close to. We had to get him back in.
Yes. I'm recording.
She was just a. Before,
yeah,
oh,
we had
okay,
to kind
okay.
of,
yeah,
yeah, just work it. So I think maybe you
went in a booth and spazzed out and said something wild.
Yeah.
I think we had our hands full with like making sure that actually got on the radio, let alone like being a hit. But I remember when we mixed it on there, it was a Sunday night, wasn't it?
Yeah, in the old studio.
In the old studio.
Farm Lane studio. I mean, look, I have to say, like, Fraser gave me a massive, like, head start and education and just, like, yeah, mixing and finishing a record, like, straight from the start as a young wannabe A&R person, you know, how do you learn how to do these things? And we talked about this on the last show. Again, you know, you ask a lot of questions. You ask a lot of questions to older A&R people, but you ask a lot of questions of the producers that you're working with, and it just was lucky that, you know...
But you know what? If I'm honest, I didn't really know what I was doing at that point.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't.
You were leading me down a blind path.
No, I mean,
it worked out all right. So
I think I just started mixing because I thought I used to send mixes out, and I think that unless you develop like a special relationship with a mix engineer, it can become. I'm going to talk to J5 about. He's working on the Huss record, and it's funny because he's like where I was. A while ago where you're going around and you're kind of getting mixes back and you're thinking, I don't know, I kind of prefer what I did, but it's sort of better, but it's worse, and going through that whole thing, which is why I just thought, you know what, I've got to learn to mix. I was still in the, I think I've mixed, haven't mixed any of the early Kano stuff, but I mixed Strider Man, so that sort of felt good. I mixed Take Me Back, so I was on this sort of role of whatever I've done before is working, but still I don't know. I wasn't like 100%
on it,
knowing what
you was doing.
No,
I've got two questions on that actually. Firstly, that makes me ask you: did you have a mentor at the time? Did you have somebody that was kind of around you that would kind of be like, you know, think about doing a little bit of this or think about trying out that? Or did you have anybody that was around you?
No. Wish I did.
Yeah,
because I think that's an important kind of. It was always like a sounding board, but no, I don't. There's no one really around that was. There were obviously people, but the access to people, I think, was limited.
Yeah.
So I just devoured books, and I remember a lot of the early stuff was Dave Pensado, and I was lucky enough to meet that guy who's, I don't know if you know, like. Him and Pensado's Place.
Legendary,
which is basically
mix engineer and show on YouTube.
Yeah, which, to be honest, is just, that's an extension now of what he was always doing. He was always very, very gracious in magazine interviews and would always tell people how he did certain things. And I would just, like, eat all that stuff up and buy the equipment that he was suggesting.
Was
talking
about.
Yeah, so, yeah, I sort of did it in another way, you know. But
again, side note, if you're a young producer and you want to get all of those inside tricks, go and watch Fraser's interview on Pensado's Place on YouTube. It's very insightful, and there's just that guy's interviewed like just everyone and anyone who is like
that's
a great producer.
Did a good one with
engineer.
DJ Mustard as well.
Yeah, like incredible.
So also, as we're talking about from a perspective of somebody who is young and you know, we're using some terms here that some people might not really know or understand. Explain to somebody who is a young producer what mixing is and how important it is to mix a record.
So mixing is getting the balances.
Because they might think you're a DJ mixing or something
right,
like
that. Right,
yeah. Turntable yeah, mixing or something. Yeah.
Getting the balance right between all the instruments, separation so that you can hear where the instruments are placed in the stereo field, so that not everything's in the middle, so that you can feel like it's a panoramic experience. It's placing things at the forefront and at the back, so you can, I mean, if you're listening to music, everyone's experiencing it in different ways, but I mean, I tend to think of it as more of a three-dimensional image.
Yeah.
And I think that if you listen to good mixes, they're very spacious and you can hear, there's a lot of separation, so you can pick out where certain things are.
Yeah.
So it's equalizing things to make things brighter or make things hit harder. That's with compression, so you can bring things to the fore. So it's like, it's super creative. It's very technical, but actually it's a lot of fun because it's like framing the picture but adding depth and feel to your.
And it's even more important to do that with a whole album, because there's nothing worse than like, and I know a lot of people will understand when I say this, you'll get a mixtape, for example, you'll put the mixtape in your headphones or in your car, and you're constantly turning it down, turning it back up, turning it down, turning it back up, because it hasn't really had the right mix. So there's no continuity in terms of the sound, right?
Yeah, for sure. So it's important. It's important.
So, you know, around that time, post all of the Tinchy stuff, you were doing like James Morrison, Nelly Furtado, Broken Strings, you were doing Tayo, Break Your Heart, Dynamite, first Billboard number one.
I didn't do that.
I did
Break Your Heart.
Break Your Heart.
Was my first. Dr. Luke, Max Martin.
Okay.
Get out of here. Let's talk about Break Your Heart then.
Amazing moment.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, you were doing the Tayo stuff, Cheryl Cole.
Yeah.
Wow. Britney Spears.
Britney Spears.
CeeLo.
What? CeeLo.
CeeLo, yeah. Okay.
And
good fun.
And the Queen, Adele.
Yeah.
So when did you meet Adele?
Side note, I'm just talking through her mic right now, just for anybody who wants to just, is, you know I mean, feel the ambience, through the, you know, come mic. On.
To be honest, I don't know what she'd listened to, Adele had listened to come in. Like, whether it was, I'd done so many, at that point I'd had the Tinchy stuff come out, I'm not sure if she was a Kano fan, probably is, knowing her, you know, she likes to rap. I had Broken Strings, Nelly Furtado and James Morrison and like lots of other stuff.
So let's just say she was absolutely banging Strider Man, and that was what.
Let's say that. Yeah. I mean,
that's what brought her in, right?
Yeah.
So how did the call come? How did that call come?
Dell's manager, Jonathan Dickens, said, well, we set up a meeting, just come and hang out for a bit, have a cup of tea and talk about stuff. And had a great first meeting with her. And then she came in and we spent like 4 days together. We wrote like a couple of tunes to begin with, were kind of piano based. And then she said, if I was Rihanna, what kind of thing would I do? Because I think she'd probably heard like that I'd done mid sort of up tempo stuff, and she I think she said she liked my drums that she'd heard. So I set up a loop on the MPC and had the piano riff that I'd just started playing in the morning, which was Set Fire to the Rain piano riff, and just started playing it. And she came in and was into it and started singing some melodies over the top and developed that song over the period of 2 days.
Okay.
I mean, the melodies to her came quite easy because she's incredible, and then she takes a lot of time over the lyrics. So she would, I don't know if you remember, Ben, the studio, well, you remember it. Farm Lane.
That was the where you did the number one? Okay. Yeah.
So there's a lot of time where she would go out to the kitchen. Do you remember the kitchen was like outside, yeah, stop the steps?
I remember the kitchen.
Yeah. Smoke two packets of cigarettes. not that much, but felt like it. And just come with lyrics, come back and say, you know, what do you think of these? And we finished the song. But interestingly, at that point, she said the record's going to be produced by Rick Rubin, so don't worry too much about the production. But obviously, to me,
what does this mean? Explain to me what this means.
Well,
what does she mean? What did she mean by that?
Basically, she knew she was going to go to Malibu to record her record.
So she was
Rick.
Okay.
So she was writing with myself, Paul Epworth, various people to come up with the songs to then take those songs to Rick, who would produce the album.
Oh, okay, I get you.
So she said to me, look, don't worry about, you know, don't worry about the production. But that's a little bit like saying Claudia Schiffer wants to go out for dinner with you, but just come as you are. You don't have to like worry about changing. You don't have to get changed. You know, just come in like come in like your jeans. I mean, you're going to want to make sure that piano's. It's going to Rick.
Yeah.
It's going to Rick. You want to make sure the drums feel
proper.
So I remember saying, that's fine. I'll just work out the demo. But obviously then spent like 4 days straight on making the song sound pretty good. And I mean, but to be honest, it was the MPC, like drum loop, tom loop. I added some program strings on it and had the piano, had her vocal. And I mean, going back to like that feeling that you get in the studio, and I keep saying, like, please don't think I'm big-headed, but please don't think I'm big-headed, because I would write maybe 300 songs of a year in a year, of which 280 aren't used. So hopefully that brings things into perspective in terms of like a lot of the things that I do aren't used and like aren't very good. So, but when you've got something as special, well, for me anyway, when you've got something as special as Set Fire to the Rain or Break Your Heart or a lot of the songs on the Stormzy records or Made in the Manor or songs with Dave, you do know how you feel about them. And there is a different feeling that you get when you guys must know when you you're part of a big record, and it's almost like it's beyond. You hope other people like it, but you feel like even if people don't, that's fine. This just feels like a good song. So I had that agonizing wait when I'd sent the song to Rick. He said he liked the piano. Adele disappeared for, I don't know, it felt like a year.
Okay.
And she called me up out of the blue one day and said, do you want to come over to my flat in Battersea? Because I want to, like, play you a couple of things. I was like, okay, cool. Excited to hear, like, the Rick stuff.
Yeah.
And she played me the Rick stuff and she said, look, I wanted you to hear Set Fire to the Rain. I really want to hear what you think about it. And it was funny because she didn't say what she thought about it at all. And the way that Rick had produced it, I mean, it sounded amazing, as it would because it's Rick Rubin, it was like a halftime thing. So it just felt like didn't have that. Set Fire to the Rain is that sort of beat, but this was very, very slow. And he said, what do you think about it? It was like the sort of $1 million question. So I thought, well, I'll just be honest. I said, look, I'm a massive fan of Rick Rubin, but this isn't doing it for me.
Yeah.
You know, this is just not the way that I feel. The song feels like a early, like, U2 beat with the toms, quite tribal, and I think we've lost it. And she said, well, actually, I agree. She goes, I love Rick as well, but I feel like what we had on the demo was the thing. So she said, how would you finish the demo and make it into a finished record? And I said, well, I'd get my friend Ash to play drums on it and we'd get some live strings. And I think your vocal's amazing. You can try it again, but I think we've got it. And that basically became the finished record. I let it fall.
How does life change as a producer after that? Because I guess, you know, and I'm just... I can't talk for everyone else's, you know, ambition, but, you know, we're on the island that is England, or the country that is Great Britain, and, you know, it's probably, yeah, well, it's most definitely like one of the most influential places for music, but we are forever looking at the States and thinking that's the holy grail. And whether you're a writer, a producer, or an artist, you know, a lot of people aspire to break the States or like getting in there. So, I mean, post, I know that you'd worked with American artists prior to the success of the Adele record, but did things change significantly in any way for you post the Grammy?
They did, actually, in a lot of ways, and some amazing and some, I'd say, not so good.
Okay.
In a way, I think the amazing things are that the doors open to work with lots of different artists. So for me, that was more about growing. So I working with artists like CeeLo and Brittany and Celine Dion and these wide ranging artists was incredible. I'd say that I grew a lot as a producer through that time. Yet I feel, looking back, it can also be tough, because I think people are viewing you in a slightly different way. People are viewing you as potentially being like way too expensive for their budgets, which has never been the case, because I will always look at anything that I want to do, I'll always try and make it happen. You know, as long as I can put the lights on in the studio, you know, I'm down for doing it. I mean, Strider Man, I remember being paid in Star in the Hood t-shirt money from that a few installments, I think, if I'm right. You know, I mean, if you want to do something, you know, you can, there's always a way. But
it's circumstantial.
But I think also stylistically, because that Set Fire to the Rain was such a big song, I think that people, it was the biggest song that I'd ever done, but people had forgotten the stuff that came before that. And I think there was a big drive to be in the States, primarily, like, this is the guy that you go to and you get the ballad and he can do this piano evocative ballad type of thing, which frustrate, I mean, it's very flattering, but it was also frustrating because I mean, the music that we've been talking about is not ballad type of music. You know, the music I grew up listening to, playing, it's got a little bit more influence from street culture, from hip-hop. It's always come back to that. Yet I found myself for a long time wanting to work with artists, and those artists, through no fault of their own, but were viewing me as the guy that wrote Set Fire to the Rain, so I'd be going out to the MPC and saying, yeah, we can, why don't we try something like this? And say, oh, no, I feel like, you know, let's go over to the piano, which is fair enough. But the problem with that is that there is only one Adele. And I think that we captured a moment there. And there are a lot of people trying to be Adele at that point because they felt, you know, this is, as any singer, most singers are wanting to be Adele. But that's a moment in time. So I found myself in a little bit of a loop of people wanting to make that kind of music, which wasn't really me anyway. I think Set Fire to the Rain was just a sort of collision of me coming off the back of Kano and Tinchy and Tyler Cruz and working with Adele, that was obviously coming from an Amy Winehouse-y, soul, Carole King sort of place. And it was just this happy accident. And I think that then to try and replicate that is always very, very difficult. So
isn't that the unfortunate thing about the music industry? And maybe you could say in a lot of different industries too. I can't speak on it. I can only speak on what I'm around in. But, you know, there always seems to be this reoccurrence of when somebody does something hugely successful and people are a part of it, then other people say, okay, I want that same team, like, so I want that producer to then do that again for this person, or I want this person to come and film this for that person. But, you know, to create great music doesn't really work like that, does it?
No. And I think because Americans feel like they're better at exploiting the commercial side better than we are in England. I think that Americans seem better at doing that in terms of artists, producers, like say Pharrell will get on a roll and he'll just be able to give you different variations of what people love, and he does that so well. But it obviously comes to a point where he saturates the market, because you know, you've got like the top 20 songs in the Billboard chart have that Pharrell sound. So then he goes and he reinvents himself and he comes back, and that's his genius at work. Whereas what I did was I thought, you know what, I'm just going to grow in as many different areas as I can. So I'm going to, because I was lucky enough to have built up a reputation as someone that was musical. I worked with bands. I worked with Kaiser Chiefs and the Kooks, and I worked with different kinds of singers like Mickey Echo. I worked with Bipolar Sunshine, and just spread it out. And then I started working with Kano again on Made in the Manor. Really of a down to a labour of love, because he was out of a deal, and I desperately wanted to do something that I just really felt invested in and massively passionate about. And I think we went into that record knowing that we both said that we wanted to create something that was his black album. He was saying that from the beginning, something that was going to be his,
a moment for him,
his moment. But that moment was, he was swimming against the tide, because grime wasn't like it is now. At that point, you know, this was two years in the making. So it's 3-4 years ago.
Okay.
So literally a labour of love, and down to our relationship and tracks we'd done over the years, we're just enjoying each other's company. You know, he was jumping on the MPC as he did the first day I ever walked
in. He'd grown a lot, I take it. So, because obviously the first time he'd come in, he wasn't saying that much. Now he's a bit older.
He's a bit more banter in the studio. But still, you know, he's a serious guy and would still, you know, would still, very, very deep thinker. I mean, I don't think you can get lyrics like that and emotions like that on the mic without being a very deep, special guy, you know. 69 man a road Sunday morning.
Let's talk about the Berklee courses that you've done, right? It's documented that you said that those courses had helped, played a bit a part in the record that you did with Adele. Talk to me a little bit about the courses to begin with, actually, just for somebody who doesn't know what a Berklee's course is.
Okay, so Berklee College of Music was a college that I always wanted to go to when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But, like, the funds, my personal funds didn't allow that, because overseas students, just getting over there was, like, so much money. Even if you got a scholarship, it was, like, super expensive. So American aspiring musicians go to this college, which is started off as, like, a jazz college, really, but now they do everything from music production to, you can still go there if you're an amazing cellist or if you want to be a manager, but it's this amazing college with a huge campus in Boston and has gigs the way you can play, and it's just an incredible place, and all sorts of people that have come out of there, from John Mayer to Gary Burton to Steve Vai, the guitar player. I mean, it's the alumni there is phenomenal. So I found out that you could do online courses, and they're 3-month courses, so 12 weeks, and you can do literally everything from film scoring to guitar playing to mixing to piano playing. So I've done like 15 of these courses.
Have they helped you? How important have they been? You know, going forward with some of the production that you've been doing since that moment to today?
Seminal. I mean, say from doing a piano course, learning how to play the piano, so playing the piano on Set Fire to the Rain, mixing courses. I did 2 mixing courses, and I actually did they invited me to go over there to talk about my online journey with them, you know.
You must be the most successful online student they've ever had.
I think I am. And but what was really like uncanny, and I had to sort of have a disclaimer on the speech when I was talking to these guys, because I said, look, I'm not, I mean, Berkeley brought me over here, which is great, but I mean, they're not paying me any money to say what I'm going to say. Mm. But I said, I've just done a thing where I've looked at the years of when I did all these courses, these 15 courses, and I've done, just done a timeline of what happened when I did the course and what happened in my career. And it was literally like two mixing courses, mix a number one record, learn how to play piano and Set Fire to Rain. I mean, it was
wow,
like a ridiculous
yeah
thing. But I've done lyric courses and melody, singing, Ableton Advanced, ear training,
okay,
music business,
wow,
like a lot of stuff, and I'm still going. I mean, I'm nowhere near done yet.
Where does that thirst for just knowledge and just wanting to constantly better yourself come from? Is that something that came over time, or were
chronic
you always...
insecurity?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe.
But you know, were you always someone who was like studious or
no? Okay. Never. Never. So
because I've always known you to be doing these courses, and I'm always like, how does Fraser find the time? I still don't understand. I think he works on a different clock. I think there's like 48 hours in his one day, because the amount this man squeezes into a day is crazy to me. But
well, I think, I mean, the first thing to say is that when we first started working together and had that incredible time with Tinchy, I was at 38.
Yeah.
So I started having success relatively late. Kind of very late compared to some people, you know. I mean, Dave was 18.
It's a really important point, actually.
Yeah.
Again, just because everybody's so impatient.
Yeah.
And wants to make it in their 20s.
Yeah.
So I think that it is a...
Or even feeling like they failed because they didn't make it in their
100%, 100%. 100%. And yeah. I've forgive me, but I have this conversation with people and I say, look at Fraser. Look at him. Like, the man is, like, one of the most successful people that I've met in music, full stop. You know, but I wasn't there witnessing the hard graft before. I just met you and you were just having success. But yeah, you were 38 when it's...
Mm.
started. I mean, that's, you know,
so I think at the beginning it was, I realized that coming out of the Craig thing, there wasn't so much stuff online, so I just had to find like the source of what could really tell me what was going on with this mixing, because I used to send stuff off, used to come back, I didn't understand it left me like baffled. So I'm not naturally a studious person at all, but to find this place where I could go and I could log in every day and I could do my assignments and do this work and actually just realise and understand what really was going on. Because it's still, even like with lyric writing or melody writing or a lot of aspects of the music business, it is a bit of a dark art of no one's... There's places, you obviously amazing schools in the UK now, ACM and Brit School. So I feel like people are coming with a lot more knowledge, but yeah, I always just feel very, I mean, I'm getting there now, but honestly, like, this year is the first year that I've felt like I can really produce.
Okay.
Like, honestly, like, I kind of understand the breadth.
You feel more complete.
On. Yeah.
In terms of...
Yeah, because I think there's so many sides to it. And I think that if you're... I thought about this a lot. I think that the difference between anyone that's good and anyone that struggles is a level of talent. But I think actually the difference, and I see it so much with artists and producers, is if you're real with yourself, you're able to put whatever you've got going, whether it's a mix or a song or a lyric or a vocal take, on the level with something else which you view as of a very, very high standard. It doesn't have to be super successful, but just something else that's really good, and be able to tell the difference between the two. And I think that is the crucial kind of difference. I mean, X Factor is a real obvious portrayal of that, because you'd see, I mean, it's sort of gladiatorial, isn't it? How on Saturday nights, you know, we watch, some of us sort of watch X Factor, and the funniest bit, the best bit, is usually the beginning.
But
what we're laughing at is really is where people are deluded, and they can't understand why they're not being signed up by Simon Cowell immediately.
Yeah.
And I think that's like an extreme example. But I see a lot of people, a lot of artists that struggle, that can't necessarily, I mean, like you've been in A&R for a long time, Ben, I don't know what you think about that, but where there's a slight lack of understanding between where you are and where other people are. And I think that if I look at the people that I really, really respect out there in terms of whatever, like string composers or beat makers or keyboard players or lyricists or whatever, I'm very far off where I would like to be.
Yeah.
So, and there's always someone new coming through, and always 18-year-old who's making better beats than me, and that really annoys me.
that competition spirit in you, I like that. All right, Big Mike with the beard, Stormzy. I want to know everything. I want to know the conversation that you and Twin B had. We've interviewed Twin B. He was the first on our. A guest, as it goes.
He was
our first guest. That we
had. What a guy.
And
what a guy.
I believe that he had a conversation with you, and he had a conversation with Stormzy, in it being a good idea that you work together. What was that conversation like with Twin, and why do you feel he came to you? Why did he feel like you would be a good person to kind of start this, what would be a phenomenal project with Stormzy? Because, you know, bearing in mind that we all know that Stormzy has had, prior to this, is that the hottest kid in the street. So everyone's looking at, you know, the next body of work, the album, which is going to be one of the most important periods of his career. Why you? Why did he come to you?
Twin said, look, I've been working with Stormzy, and I think it'd be a really good idea for him to come in, look at working with you on a body of work, but start with a week and just see how you guys work together. He said, I think it would be a great idea, because you would push him. He said he's got massive ideas, but he needs someone to be able to help foster those ideas and to help put those ideas into practice. Yeah, he knew that I could play a few instruments and would be able to get live players in and take what he already got, which was obviously amazing, into a slightly different place. So I had the initial meeting with Stormzy, and I mean, really at that point, after having worked so hard on Made in the Manor with Kane, I loved what Stormzy was doing, but I wasn't drawn to like the hype. So I thought, if anything, that would be a negative in terms of making a record with Stormzy. I thought, I really want to hear what Stormzy has to say about the record that he wanted to make, to commit to working with him. Because I felt I didn't want to repeat what Kane and I had done on Made in the Manor. And I always feel like when I'm in the studio with someone, I have to be giving them something that they can't, well, I can't get it somewhere else, but I have to feel like I'm of service to them in a way. So we got talking, and he was...
Where, in the studio here?
Here, literally.
Oh, here?
Yeah,
okay.
Here.
Okay.
And we immediately hit it off. I loved his ambition in terms of what he was wanting to achieve in terms of the styles and sonics and... adding live instrumentation, but keeping the roots of his grime upbringing and not turning his back on the scene, but opening up the whole genre. And he said that his life was about gang signs on one hand and prayer on the other, and he mentioned his faith, and then we hit on the gang signs and prayer title from that
conversation.
Yeah, it was literally like a spark where we just looked at each other and we said, oh, it sounds like the album title, and then we just got talking. It was like a think tank from then. I said, well, this could be amazing, because the gang signs could be the bass and the drums, and the prayer could be the strings and the harps and the choir, and suddenly like the whole visual aspect of the record, I could picture it. And I think that working from that concept was really important moving forward. And I think it was interesting that from that very beginning conversation, we had a thread that runs throughout the whole record that hopefully brings together the pretty diverse gospel, yet grime, yet R&B, yet...
It's interesting to hear you talk about his ambition for wanting to sort of transcend the box, I guess, of grime, because he's actually always had that, as far as I'm concerned. When you listen to Dreamer's Disease, it's not a grime EP, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. And I think like Stormzy was defined by like a few huge records that happened to be at 140, but actually like going to see his show even early on, like he had big sections where it was like very down tempo and like quite melodic and probably like quite weird to see if you bought a ticket because like you wanted to come and see like Nomi From or whatever, you know, and you're going and you're seeing a show where like he was just doing actually what he wanted to do, you know. And I saw that show a couple of times in London and once in Birmingham, and just thought like it's going to be interesting to see where he goes with that, because I'm not going to sit here and say I think that he was executing it, like nailing it at that point, but you could see the ambition was there, you know. So it's no surprise, like, actually when you come and listen to this album, like just how broad it is and diverse it is in terms of concepts, tempos, musicality, all of these things, you know. And he always had that, definitely.
Yeah,
and I think it's good that Twin has kind of had that foresight and thought you guys should actually pair up, because you've managed to really realize that for him on this record, which is amazing, by the way.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, we worked across the record for 10 months. Stormzy lives pretty close, so like that work that he was in every day, and we started off with a week together, and we recorded Blinded by Your Grace Part 1.
Okay.
In that week.
Was it always called Part 1? Did he always have the vision there was going to be two parts of that?
Yeah. Or? Yeah. He thought it was going to be two parts, but I think he felt like, because Part 1 is quite sweet, that Part 2, he had this little choir sample that he brought in, and he always thought it was going to go into like quite a dark grime beat after that. And we did that for a while, and it just wasn't sitting that well. So on that, I said, look, let's just, it doesn't have to necessarily like segue from one to the other. Let's just treat it. I think he came up with that idea. He said, look, let's just treat Part 2 as this other thing. So I was just playing around with the chords, and Storms, he said, you know, I like that bit of it. How about it goes to there? And it goes to these, you know, slightly different place. And I responded to that, and we looped that for a while. And he was out there. I'm not quite sure what was going on, because he was always in the studio, but he was like outside of the room. He literally came back and said, oh, you know, I've got some melodies, and started singing the majority of what the the track is.
Okay.
Which I think if you... Because I think because Emenike is on it, there's nothing taking anything away from Emenike, because Stormzy had come with the majority of the melody, and then Emenike came and just put this incredible new take on his section and just took it from an amazing place to some other amazing place, you know. So Emenike did an incredible job, but what's important to know is how much Stormzy did at the very beginning of that, before Emenike came in.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, to people that didn't necessarily know the depth of Stormzy's musicality, you could say, well, maybe Emenike came up with the melodies. Stormzy sang it, of course. Did his verse. Yeah.
That would be the easiest thing to say. I mean,
you know, there'd be... A lot of people would think that, but really Stormzy's melodies are incredible. I mean, Cigarettes and Kush, all him.
Yeah.
Velvet's
one of my favourite. That's one of my favourite songs,
The Nao sample, but a lot of the melodies on that. I think he'd worked on a few in America, but he's super musical guy.
And you brought a choir in, did you say? Did you mention earlier about...
We went to Harlem.
You went to Harlem.
Yeah.
Harlem.
Yeah. Okay. I actually just thought, I mean, we've been working for like 7-8 months, like every single day here. I just thought, we need to get out of the studio.
Yeah.
And I just want like the Harlem choir to be on this record. I just felt like I wanted that to see that.
Yeah. Had you heard them before? I mean, like, how did you come across them? Like, why was that even in your mind?
I am close to Damon Albarn. And
What was wrong with the Croydon choir? Like, what was...
Nothing wrong with the Croydon
choir. Yeah.
The choir maybe better. Maybe better, but something about that Harlem.
You feel.
And I just love telling people the fact that, you know, me and Stormzy, we're going to Harlem. We're going to record these guys.
I think even from here, we know there are amazing choirs here. Like, obviously, there's got to be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, we always... When you do think of like some of the biggest choirs as well, you do think of like choirs in America and like how vibey they are and
amazing. So we literally booked the... I think the schedule was quite crazy finishing the record. So we literally were there for a day, got off the plane straight into the studio. Actually, excuse me, underestimated massively the amount of time that we'd need. Mm. I don't know why. We just thought we'd send the parts and we could just... It would just happen, and it was incredible. But I wish we'd had a little bit more time to spend there, because we got 90% of what we needed. But it was like we just should have had more time, basically. But it was an incredible experience.
Just like the vision of like you've rang up the Harlem Gospel Choir, like, guys, like I've got this like British rapper. Stormzy, we want to come over, we've got this song, we want to record it. What are they thinking? Like, what is their reaction? Because are they like oblivious to like, you know, where Stormzy's at or what he's doing? Like, are they doing these sessions every day? This is just another session for them. They're just knocking this out like it's nothing. Like, how was that whole...
I mean, the American session thing is quite... When the time's up, they're out.
Okay.
Yeah. So we got there maybe a little bit late. Yeah. I don't know, like the plane was delayed, customs, whatever. So I'm thinking, looking at the watch, thinking we need to like establish a thing here pretty quickly. No, I think they were pretty oblivious.
Yeah.
I think a few people were like, "Oh, we've heard of this guy. Oh, maybe they've googled him," but it wasn't like... It was actually weird for me. Going outside with Stormzy, because bearing in mind we'd work, it's kind of weird when you think about it, we worked together for like 7 or 8 months, yet never stepped out of this building
of course.
With him. Yeah. And suddenly we were at the airport and I was like, wow, like this is kind of scary in that people were coming up and I was thinking, just me and him traveling, and you could tell that it was, you can just feel that this could get out of hand. In Terminal 4 or whatever, really quickly going onto the plane, and like people are like, "Oh, Stormzy.
Kind of completely different, right?
I'm blinded by your grace.
Rain was falling,
I saw Stormzy a lot over the summer as well. He was doing a lot of the big stages at the time, and he debuted Cold. Yeah, I think the first time he did it, maybe it might have just been one of them moments where he's like, this is the first time I'm doing this, nobody's ever heard this before, whatever. I mean, he might have done it a couple of times before, because I saw him do it a few times afterwards, but he did Cold, and like the whole place was just going crazy. Like, at that, he just did a little bit of it.
Where was that, in Germany? Or was he like?
No, it was here. I think, I can't remember the festival it was. He was main stage, big festival, somewhere far out of the ends anyway, yeah. And it was popping off, and he did it a couple of times. Talk to me about the finishing part of the album, though. Like, where did it finish? Where did it finish? Like, at what point was it like, all right, we're done. Like, we're done here. There's nothing that needs to be added anymore. Like, where was that? What song was it?
Very last song was Lay Me Bare.
Okay.
So we always knew that Lay Me Bare was going to be this deep, emotional outpouring of emotion on a beat. We tried a few different beats. Stormzy didn't feel that right about any of them. So, but we always knew that that was going to be the last thing that we did, like the very last kind of gasp of the album. What I didn't realise is that when he said last, that would actually mean like the day before it was going to be mastered. You're like, this last in my mind was like, you know, when we finish the record, we're going to mix it and then it's all nice. But last was literally like finishing at 3 o'clock in the morning when we're mastering.
Okay.
Or, you know. So I think when he put his verse down on that, that felt that was a missing, the last missing piece in the puzzle. And by that time, we kind of got a track list. And I said to him, maybe we don't need Lay Me Bare. You know, maybe it's like we finish on Shut Up and it sort of comes full circle, the journey, and we sort of finish with like your big tune. And he said, no, I just really feel like I've got a few things to get off my chest. And actually, as that happened, it just worked really well. And the process was that Stormzy got a vocal sample, which is a quad sample, and some piano from EY, the producer.
Okay.
EY sent it over, and then we did the drums and vocals and bass and stuff here in one night.
Okay.
So it's kind of brought together like very, very quickly, but a lot of people say they like that
track. How was it to sort of exec produce the record and collaborate with other producers that had maybe started ideas or, you know, had tracks at varying stages, but it was really your job to tie it all together and finish some of the tracks, maybe just mixing some of them, maybe really doing additional production or co-production of some of the records? Like, how was that experience for you as, I guess, an overseer?
It was, I mean, as you said, it was taking like the big picture, I think, was the most important thing. So coming back to the concept and listening to, you know, the songs, but it, to be honest, it, as you just said, it was a very three-dimensional approach. Yeah. Because on one hand, we were writing lyrics together for Blinded by Your Grace. On another hand, I was mixing it with Manon. So it was like multiple roles. Which I think is what I always enjoy most.
Yeah.
So, but obviously, taking the overview with Stormzy was, you know, a big thing.
Yeah.
I think, and hearing the beats that he was bringing in, seeing how we could make them better, how we could bring them in line with the rest of the record, adding the live elements to them. Seeing any gaps that needed to be filled in terms of sonics or other tracks that we needed to write, or, but I mean, Stormzy's an incredible visionary, so it's really working with him to help him achieve what's going on in his head.
Yeah.
and I don't think you can credit him enough with what he brings to the table.
And that's why I think he's a special artist as well, because even what you said before, you know, Dreamer's Disease wasn't it's not a grime EP. And I always thought that when he was coming into making this project, like, what does he do now? Because he's had these like big grime records, does he now make an album for what he thinks that people want to hear from him? Or does he do what he just wants to do in his heart? Do you get me? And that's why I think that, yeah, it was probably one of the best decisions that he could have made, coming and working with somebody like you and collaborating and being able to come and sit down and just, you know, have these ideas in his head and you be able to musically help him put it together. Do you know what I mean? And you essentially did what Rick Rubin did for Adele, innit?
There you go. You
Rick Rubin Stormzy.
I guess so.
And I'll say this. What he was trying to do on Dreamer's Disease, like, he has executed and nailed on Gang Signs and Prayers.
Prayer,
like, he really has. And look, you know, the album is out now. It's crazy. If you don't have it, buy it and then stream it.
If you do have it, buy another copy.
Buy another copy. Buy the physical copy.
I actually think it's one of them albums, yeah, that you you should have a physical copy of. I'm not even just trying to plug it like that. I just think that you have what you get. Occasionally, you get those albums that mean something for a period of time or at a period of time.
Yeah.
And to symbolize that and to be a part of that, I think it's one of those things where you go out and you don't just stream it. You don't just, you know, download it on iTunes. You actually buy a copy of that and you hold that and you're like, you know what, I remember. You can look back on that and say, yeah, like, I remember that moment that when Stormzy did a madness.
And as we speak, you know, the album's in the chart. We've got 2 days left until Friday. It's incredibly close between, you know, him and Rag & Bone.
We say
2 days
left to Friday, but we don't know when this is coming out, bro.
This
is coming out on Wednesday.
Coming out tomorrow.
You know, for people, this
is
podcast and that.
This is a podcast. So. Like, for him to have a number one, like, honestly, not from my point of view, from Stormzy's point of view and the point of view, I think, like, the scene, obviously I'm, like, massively invested, but for him to have that number one...
Yeah.
...is...
huge.
I think it just means so much, because I think no one else from the scene has had that number one, so I feel it could be a moment in time.
Yeah.
For him and for the grime scene.
All right. I want to say I can't thank you enough for doing this, actually.
I think you enough for coming to the studio.
It's been a very productive conversation. And as I say all of the time, you know, I learn a lot from doing stuff like this and for having these type of conversations. And there's a lot of people out there that want to know and want to hear this. And if there's one little thing that can be said that could inspire them to go on and do great things, then you know what, like, I would feel fulfilled in that. And I know that there's a lot of things that you've said today that would definitely help a lot of people and you know, that people would find very interesting. Is there anything else, like, on special that you're working on at the moment that you want to throw in?
I'm working with the incredibly talented Dave.
Oh, yes. Come on.
The Santan.
Oh, yes. Miss Santan, you know.
Santan.
Yeah. So that's the... You connected again, you two.
Yeah. But, I mean, Dave is... I mean, I'm, like I said, coming here every day, it's like being a kid in the sweet shop. But if you haven't got the artists to work with, I mean, you know, I'm not the guy that can send out beats. I don't gas myself up making music on my own. For me, it's about collaborating. So therefore, if I don't have the right artists, I'm dead. You know, so to work with all the incredible, if you just take out the singers and take out the bands, but just look at MCs and you look at, you know, Kane and Getz and Jay Haas and now Stormzy and now working with Dave is taking things on, you know. His musicality is where me and him really bond. So he'll play on the piano. The first track that we ever wrote was Picture Me, which was the first real meeting, wasn't it? We tried him the first time, he overslept. We didn't really get to meet. He came in the second time. I was playing guitar, he was jamming on the piano, and I think what's exciting for me is that Dave brings something to the table that isn't Stormzy and isn't Getz and isn't Jay Huss and isn't Kane. And I think that
it's Dave.
That it's Dave. And I think that Dave couldn't exist without Stormzy or without Kane or without all the amazing MCs out there. But the incredible thing is that he's drawing also from Pink Floyd and from Sega Mega Drive music and from Epic, Schindler's List, film soundtracks. So
he's a special kid, man.
He is a very
Dave's a very special kid.
So I think that's what's truly exciting me at the minute.
Yeah man. Well, is there anything you want to add to that? Well,
I mean, look, it's a blessing to be able to see him and Fraser, you know, enjoying creating music again. And it's like, you know, Dave is like, I don't know how to describe him, but what, like, musically, what he wants to, like, put down on a record and what he wants to kind of just express, like, it's, you've got to keep up with him in the studio, I think. And I think he would probably overwhelm a lot of people. So it's a blessing to be able to come in with someone like Fraser into a place like this and, you know, work with Manon as well and just really, like, see him happy that he's able to realise his vision. Like, honestly, because, that kid has got an insane amount of content within him and a mad amount of ideas in his head. And I think, like, not meeting someone like Fraser would be terrible for him. I think he would be very frustrated not to be able to get those ideas out and collaborate and whatever, you know. So it's great. It's a beautiful thing to watch and see. And I know that it's good when you can see both parties really enjoying it. So it's great. I'm excited to see what comes off it. Obviously, they've done the 6-Path CP together, and now it's, you know, it's onwards and upwards, and I guess, you know, more records and eventually album time. So, yeah.
And congratulations on 1&0 as well, because obviously that's crazy. Just gone through the roof of Dave as well.
Let's not forget 169 as well. He's that guy that comes into the studio, and I'm like, how did you just make something so amazing in like 3.5 minutes?
Yeah.
You know?
I was chatting to Tyrell earlier today, and he just sent me like this folder of beats, and I was like, what the send me more beats, like, please. Like, I don't really like sit and just listen to beats much anymore, but he just sent me this folder of beats, and I was like, these beats are insane.
Man, well, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you for coming.
I'm sure, like, once more stuff, more Grammys, more awards, Dave goes through the roof, all of these other acts, we'll do a part two.
100%.
I'll interview
you.
Oh yeah, maybe, why not?
There you go.
Yeah, after I do like Jay-Z, Beyonce, you can sit and chat to me about.
He's going to do a Berklee course right after this.
Yeah.
But no, Fraser, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for sitting down with us, and
Thanks for inviting me on.
No, all good.
Man, wicked.
We'll be back 2 weeks time. Neighborhood show.
Yeah, man. Peace.
Nice.
You're getting way too big for your boots. You're never too big for the boot. I got the big size toes on my feet.